and welcome to Ride the Omnibus. I'm your host, Ariel Baska. Today, we are discussing the Netflix documentary, Crip Camp, A Disability Revolution, directed by James Lebrecht and Nicole Newman. Joining me today are fellow disability activists, Danielle Das and Irina Greenman. Danielle does work for the International Foundation for Autoimmune and Autoinflammatory Arthritis, and Irina does work as co-founder of Dawn, Disabled Action for Women and Non-Binary People. Welcome to the show. I'm so glad to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
We are talking about Camp Janed in the 70s, which is where the film Crip Camp starts. Now, Camp Janed in the 70s, as it was shown in the film, looks like a summer camp a la Woodstock. You've got people playing music all around at all times. And you have able-bodied counselors who seem kind of awestruck as the bus pulls up to this camp full of teenagers with disabilities of all kinds, sitting around playing the guitar, having interesting conversations, jumping in the lake. And you get the sense right from the beginning that the filmmakers were trying to literally immerse people who are watching the film in this world to make them maybe slightly uncomfortable as the camp counselors themselves might have been. How did you guys react to that approach?
I thought it was interesting. At first, to be honest, I got a little bit defensive almost, because they were approaching it from the perspective of the able-bodied counselors, and then you find out a few minutes later there are disabled counselors as well, and it was like, whoa, wait a minute, why am I looking at it then only from the able-bodied perspective? But when I sort of considered, okay, well, they're probably not making this documentary for disabled people and disability activists as much as they're making it for able-bodied people to go, hey, let's challenge some of your beliefs here, and you know, let's challenge the way you're thinking and the way you're viewing this. Then I sort of warmed up to it a little bit and was like, okay. I see what you're trying to do here. Particularly because I think maybe 15 or 20 minutes in, the film shifts and you start seeing a lot more from the perspective of the disabled campers and some of the disabled counselors, people like that.
I find the subtitle of the film, the mentioning the revolution and the overtly reminiscent of that lyrics to the music that's being played at the beginning. You know, it's talking about this revolution, among other things, first of all, as if it's over, and then proceeds to show everything from an able-bodied perspective. And if there's this revolution, why are we still looking at everything from an able-bodied perspective? And I felt that it in some ways sort of weakened that intro a little bit, because it's supposed to be this concept of this revolutionary movement that is meant to change the way the world thinks and sees about people with disabilities, and the idea that the disabled perspective is suddenly not so much the other, but then it proceeds to do exactly that. On the other hand, I also know that this was a film they were trying to sell to an audience, and that's probably the smarter move in terms of simply trying to make a movie that a larger audience would watch.
Mm-hmm. And I honestly think for a film that tries to capture something about the broader area of disabilities as a whole, rather than one specific area of disabilities and disability activism, I think it is definitely the one film I've ever seen that attempted to do that and was fairly successful in at least getting some degree of public attention.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
And I do think that in that way, this film was successful by coming in through the able-bodied perspective at the beginning. We can discuss later whether we think that was, whether or not we could have used some more perspective from the different teenagers with disabilities or the activists at the end. Personally, I would have loved for this documentary to be an actual mini series rather than one film, but you can only have what you can have. But the one thing I did like about the ableist perspective was it allowed them to have the line where Larry, the camp director, says, "We discovered the problem wasn't people with disabilities. It was our problem."
Yeah, yeah.
And you can only say that if you're specifically talking to an audience of able-bodied people.
Right. Yep. And, you know, I'm really interested in writings and public speeches given by people about the social model of disability. You know, this idea that my illness does not disable me, your society is what is disabling me. You know, I can get into your building just fine if you weren't so emotionally attached to these stairs, that, and that kind of thing. And so to hit that note right off, you know, I was like, oh, okay, all right, you, I'm listening. You got me.
Yeah, it was that line. It was that line that made me say, okay, I'm, you know, you've earned my listening.
Yeah, it was for me too. I think all three of us responded at exactly the same moment in exactly the same way. So that says a lot.
One thing that was difficult for me, in terms of almost like a cultural lens, if you will, was, you know, being a contemporary parent, and 2020 parenting is so different than 1970s parenting. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'm looking at these images of a camp and I have no frame of reference for what camp in the 70s was like. And so I was like, oh my God, this place is neglectful. This is unsanitary. This
yep.
is disgusting.
Yep.
And then I actually had to talk to my parents, who were alive in the 70s, and they were older than teenagers at that point. But they both were like, no, Danielle, that was camp. That's not disabled camp. That was camp. And I was like, and my mom was like, why do you think I never went there? and I was like, oh, okay. All right. But I don't know what the fix is for that, you know, because the documentary is not about camp, but I almost wish that maybe, you know, somebody during one of the interviews had just drawn that parallel to, you know, oh, my sister who's not disabled went to camp every year. And so we were able to talk about our experiences and how similar they were. Maybe I would have been like, oh, okay. So they're all like this.
Particularly when they started talking about the spread of crabs throughout the camp.
I loved that part so much, and I loved the conversations around it so much.
Yeah, yeah.
The one guy who said, you know, I can't feel the lower parts of my body, so I don't feel itching, I don't feel discomfort, it doesn't bother me, you know, and he was very upset that people were being forced to clean themselves in an effort to get rid of the infection. Or infestation, rather, sorry, not infection. You know, and he was talking about how dehumanizing that might be if you were not able to tend to your own hygiene issues and someone else was aggressively trying to delouse you. And I had to really sit with that a minute, because on the one hand, I totally understand what he was saying and it made perfect sense to me. On the other hand, the entire camp is not without feeling of the lower regions of their body. And there are kids there who are itching, and there are kids there who are uncomfortable, as well as probably counselors who are itching and uncomfortable, both the able-bodied and the disabled counselors. And so, you know, crabs is not a sort of thing where you can draw a little line down the camp and go, okay, everybody who doesn't want crabs, come over here, and everybody who doesn't care, go over there. You know, they're going to spread throughout all the bedding and whatnot. So I don't know what the answer was for that, but it made me think about it in a way that I never would have.
Well, and even frankly, the young man who said, you know, I don't feel down there, so why do I have to disinfect? Okay, so maybe he doesn't feel the discomfort or whatnot, but infection is a thing, and a number of these kids were immunocompromised. This young man could still have acquired an actual infection and an illness from this. That could potentially be very dangerous. And these counselors, I don't know what legal liability they may have held. As a teacher, that was something that rang true to me.
Yeah.
I kept thinking about things like some of the conventions I've chaperoned in the summers and stuff like that. What would have happened if we had to decide what is going to happen with them. You know, one of the things the parents sign for those conventions is a thing allowing us to make medical decisions for their kids. Mm-hmm. I don't know what documents or anything might have gone into Camp Jeanette. I just don't know.
And you have to feel like there would definitely be some, even if they weren't standard at the time, because you have all of these campers that have pretty intense medical issues.
Yeah. On the other hand, I do wonder, were there documents? Because so many of these kids weren't getting proper medical care to begin with. You know, a number of them probably had issues that weren't fully documented. And their right to make their own decisions, their parents' right to make decisions for them, whatnot, wasn't fully documented. You know, their bodily autonomy wasn't put down in law by that time yet at all anyway. So I don't know what documents would have been required.
Yeah. And I found myself wondering, you know, how this could possibly be a safe environment, given that, you know, a lot of those kids easily could have suffered from seizures, since there's high comorbidity with some of the conditions that were depicted. And I kept thinking, well, you know, meanwhile, you have Larry, like, you know, digging out holes for them to trip over. And
yeah,
like, you could have, how are you prepared for this?
I really wish that they had explored that, the Larry digging the holes more,
yeah.
Because he just makes this statement. Oh, I noticed that, you know, some of the kids are really clumsy, and I thought it would be funny if they trip in these holes. And I was like, okay, so the kids, when they're interviewing the campers, I'm never getting an impression that they feel like they're being oppressed in this camp. They no indication that they feel like they're being mistreated. So I feel like there's more to that story, or
yeah,
more to the relationship that they had with Larry. You know, were they just like so happy that he was pranking them, because pranks is part of camp culture? Or is he just this asshole who's digging holes to hurt people? Like, they didn't do anything with that. They were just like, here's this thing, now on to something else.
Or was he joking? I mean, was he joking? You know?
Yeah, maybe he's digging holes for landscaping. It has nothing to do with that. And he was just, you know.
And he has a telephone pole that has to go in there or something.
Yeah, and he's saying something inflammatory because he assumes that the TV crew will be in on the joke, and they're not. Like, I don't know.
There was a bunch of equipment sitting there in the background of that shot, and I was wondering what all that was, you know. You know, and then there's even a scene just a couple seconds later in which one of the campers says, you know, oh, I love Larry.
Yeah,
you know, they clearly have a good relationship with him. I don't know what exactly is going on in that scene.
But it's interesting that they never really followed up on that at all, in terms of really talking about who he was as a character, in terms of what his philosophy was, in terms of how he structured the camp. I mean, they sort of go into the Woodstock 70s thing, and they talk about historically what Camp Jeanette had been before, very briefly. And then they talk about how historically in the 70s, where basically schools could still reject students with disabilities, employers could deny jobs for which people with disabilities were highly qualified, public spaces were largely inaccessible, and those with disabilities could be asked to leave at any time, even while taking care of government business. The question is, was it about the 70s, or was it about Larry, or was it some other driving force that led this camp to be so special and so unique in terms of actually respecting teenagers with disabilities and allowing them to feel accepted and heard?
Well, and also, you know, this is a problem with documentary media in general. There's this journalistic allergy to complex people. Everyone has to be either sort of pure and heroic and inspiring, or villainous and evil and bigot. There's very rarely anyone in between. And having done a lot of volunteering and some direct actions and things like that in the disability community with some of the people who I've met briefly some of the people who were at Camp Jened, and then I've worked closely with people who were trained by them. A lot of these people are not the sort of pure inspirational heroes that they're portrayed as, because they are human beings. And there are a lot of problematic individuals in the disability community. There's been a lot of discussion recently. There's a great hashtag on Twitter, Disability2White. There's one that's just recently been started by disability activist Anita Cameron, whom everybody should follow. She is she's an incredible queer, disabled, neurodivergent Black woman who has been arrested over 150 times, putting her body on the line for disabled rights. And she recently coined the term rabelism, which is the combination, the intersection of racism and ableism. And she coined that both as a hashtag and then also coined the hashtag rabelism tells me. And so she's been calling on other Black and brown disability activists to say, what does rabelism tell you you are? What does rabelism tell you you can or cannot do or should or should not do? What lies does rabelism tell you? And a lot of those lies come from within the community itself. Mm-hmm. And that's important to acknowledge. And some of it has come from people who are in the film.
I don't quite know how to say this, but, you know, just by definition, every single person in that film, if they were alive in the 70s, is going to qualify as a boomer in most cases, because these are not kids born in the 70s. These are people who were teenagers in the 70s. And, you know, okay, boomer is a thing for a reason. But then also I thought of, you know, they did a good job of showing how isolated most of the campers were before they went to camp, because they were so excluded from public schools, from public spaces, that really they only got to interact with their parents and people their parents deliberately put them in contact with. And, you know, where I live, the high schools here didn't integrate until 1973. So, you know, I'm not surprised, I guess is what I'm getting at, that this original crop of activists were fairly segregated, because I don't know how they could have been anything else, to be honest.
Well, and I don't blame them at all for having been segregated in 1973.
Oh yeah. I mean, they've had plenty of time to work their shit out by now, but I'm just talking about in terms of what's shown in the document.
Oh yeah. 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 No. And my problem is the fact that they're poor. And some of it is because, having looked at the credits, one of the things I did watch, though I was not able to finish the whole film, I did skip, when I skipped forward and watched bits of it to see what was included, I did also watch the credits. And some family members and friends and whatnot of those people were involved in making the film. Mm-hmm. And put an overwhelmingly positive spin on certain individuals. Mm-hmm. Who did things like get caught making racist and anti-Semitic comments on video last year.
Now, Irina, could you mention, though, why you weren't able to finish watching the film? Because I think this is important for listeners to understand.
So the reason I was not able to finish watching the film is that in the last week, four of my friends have been in the hospital, including one of my very best friends. One of the four was in the hospital critically ill, though they are no longer in critical condition. all four of them are going to make it, which was not known until yesterday that was going to be the case. And it's been a really hard week. I'm trying to keep myself under control here. Because in the last 4 years, our community has lost a huge number of people to a number of different things that were entirely preventable. This is why on March 1st, the National Council on Independent Living and a couple of other organizations with them host the Disability Day of Mourning annual vigil that is meant to to remember the those disabled people in the United States who are deliberately killed by their caregivers. And as of this past year, there were too many names to read aloud all at the vigil.
And when you say caregivers, are you talking about medical professionals? Are you talking about family members? Is it all of it?
All of the above. Personal care assistants, medical professionals, family members. A lot of it is parents and children. But it's all deliberate stuff. It's not things where, you know, somebody, the doctor tried their hardest to save the person having a heart attack and they didn't do it. It's somebody deliberately gave this person a lethal dose of their drug. It's a terrifying number. And then added to that, the sheer number who have died because their insurance wouldn't cover the thing they needed to stay alive. And they haven't all been close friends, but I have lost over 24 people in the last 4 years, just in the disability community alone. And many of them were younger than I am. And some of them were quite young. And all of it was preventable. And in this case, some of the people going into the hospital were people that I knew were at risk of being denied treatment by their insurance companies, or people who had already earlier this year been literally put out on the curb by the hospital because the hospital said, we have too many people coming in from COVID-19 today. We don't have any space for you in ICU anymore, and just put them out without any way of getting anywhere, without calling anyone, just put them out in 90 plus degree heat.
The communities that I do most of my work in are people with AI arthritis diseases and people with liver diseases, because those are my diagnosis. And so those are the ones I know the most about, and I interact with people in support groups and stuff like that. And we have, between those two communities, a very high rate of comorbidity with diabetes, mm-hmm. because a lot of the steroid treatments cause people to develop diabetes. And, excuse me, and also kidney failure is very common for people who have liver disease.
Yep.
And I cannot tell you how many people I have talked to that cannot get access to their insulin because the costs have been skyrocketing, who cannot get access to the dialysis that they need because all of the beds in the hospital are full of COVID patients. And, you know, they're just being turned away. And those statistics are not being counted. When we're told 184,000 people died from COVID, those are just the people that died from COVID. That does not include people who died from renal failure because they couldn't get their dialysis. And it does not include people who didn't, you know, who died from diabetic shock because they had been off of their insulin for too long and they weren't able to get a bed in an emergency room. It is so upsetting to me that nobody is taught. I mean, it's bad enough the way that our country is responding to COVID. That's like a whole episode in and of itself. But then the fact that absolutely nobody, even the medical professionals who absolutely know better, nobody is talking about what's happening to the chronic illness community and to the disabled community as a result of not having access to hospitals and not having access to procedures that they need and not having access to the medicine that they need. You know, when people first started saying that hydroxychloroquine was going to be a magic cure for COVID, they just bought it all up. We have people who have lupus who will die without it. And they were told, unless you have a COVID diagnosis, we will not fill your prescription. But if you went to your primary care doctor and said, I have a cough, I might have COVID, they could give you a prescription for hydroxychloroquine and it would be filled. I mean, I am filled with so much frustration and so much rage on this issue because, you know, in the beginning, I thought maybe something good could come out of the pandemic because at least able-bodied people would understand what it is like to be trapped in your house. You know, at least they would understand what it's like to be in perpetual fear of a virus and stuff like that. But it's, you know, I shouldn't have gotten my hopes up, frankly, because the response to it has been practically a pivot to eugenics. You know, idea that like, oh, well, it's only going to kill the weak, so who cares?
Yeah, that's exactly the thing we were talking about last time we were on here. was the question of which way that was going to go.
And yeah. And it seems very clear that it has definitely swung to the side of, well, you're going to die anyway, so may the odds be ever in your favor.
Well, and that's been one of the things that's been so difficult, simply about living while disabled in the last 5 years or so. In, say, 2010, if a sitting congressman had stood up and said, the piece of legislation I'm working on will kill millions of disabled people, but you know what? That's a feature, not a bug, because they're a drain on society anyway. They would have had to resign. They would have been pressured to resign from within their own party, no matter what party it was. Now, that gets said all the time.
Yeah.
By sitting politicians and sitting officials in very high positions. And it's accepted. It's completely okay to say things like that.
Yeah.
Well, and you have people suggesting that you're somehow unpatriotic if you're not willing to die so that the economy can flourish.
Right, right.
I talked to a patient who has advanced liver disease. She's on dialysis for renal failure. She's on an organ transplant list. And she lives in Arizona. And she went to a hospital for her regularly scheduled dialysis. She wasn't in crisis or anything, thank goodness. And a doctor, well, not her doctor, but a doctor at the hospital, told her to her face, I'm not going to be able to save everybody. And some of these kids on who have COVID, who are on a ventilator, I might be able to save. You and I both know, given your medical history, that your time is up eventually anyway. And that was their justification for denying her access to dialysis was, you know, we're not sure we can save you. We're pretty sure we can save some of these COVID patients.
And that brings us back to quality adjusted life years. You know, it's all that same set of metrics.
That really infuriates me, Danielle, because like I have a friend who died of kidney failure because they couldn't find her a hospital bed right now. And yeah. I mean, it's not comforting to know that even when you get access to a hospital bed, you still don't get the treatment you deserve.
We lost, our support group lost 3 people that I know of during the height of the quarantine from the pandemic because they desperately needed a liver transplant and all non-essential procedures had been cut off. And I don't think people understood that while an organ transplant is absolutely an essential procedure, the workup you need to see if you qualify as a donor was not considered an essential procedure by every hospital. And so they couldn't find a match.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then add in the whole problem of doctors not listening to patients.
Oh.
Because that's the other thing that's going on with some of the people that I know is that the situations they're in could have been completely prevented had doctors, for example, listened when they said, I have pain in my lower back just above my pelvis.
Right.
Had then any doctor in the last 2 years said, maybe we should do a urinalysis, then some of the situations now could have been prevented, you know.
I have stage 3 out of a possible 4 liver disease that absolutely could have been treated sooner. And the prognosis, if you catch it in stage 1, is fantastic. I mean, these people live long lives. By the time you get to stage 2, 3, 4, not as good. And it is 1 blood test to diagnose. And I went to doctors over and over and over again in a 10-year period saying, I am too tired. Something is wrong with me. I am always hungry. I eat and eat and eat, and I am never full, and I am so tired I can barely stand up. And every single one of them told me it was because I was gaining weight.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, nobody bothered to check and see if I was actually able to metabolize my fucking food.
Yep. I have also been in exactly that position, not with the liver issues, but with other organ issues. And it really is terrible in this country to be particularly a woman who is overweight. And have disabilities, because no matter what is wrong with you, any doctor will look at you and say that it is because you are overweight that you have problems.
Well, and I wasn't overweight when I first started going to doctors. My weight gain has been a direct result of a lot, you know, decreasing mobility and the fact that I am never full. Mm-hmm. And so when I first started going to doctors, like, I probably would have been happier if I'd lost 10 pounds, but I didn't qualify as, you know, medically overweight or anything. And, you know, that was more societal pressure to look like a model sort of deal. And in the beginning, they told me, you know, well, I don't know how to describe it, but they basically dismissed all of my symptoms as almost like a hysteria. Like, mm-hmm. you know, they recommended treatment for depression. I wasn't depressed. They recommended, you know, that I get massages because I was too stressed. It was all, you know, this idea that, like, well, you're exaggerating your symptoms, or they're in your head, or something like that. And then as soon as the weight started to pack on, you know, which was a symptom of my disease, mm-hmm. Then it became, you know, well, let's talk about your weight. Let's talk about your nutrition. Let's talk about your exercise. You know, one of the orthopedists that was treating me at the time, who had seen my x-rays, who had seen that my hip needs to be replaced, that my shoulder needs to be replaced, that I have bony calcification in my spine, all these things, said, you know, well, what are you doing in terms of exercise? And I was like, have you seen my fucking x-rays? Like, I can barely walk to the bathroom. And he said, well, you need to do water aerobics. And I was like, that would be lovely. Are you going to put in a pool in my yard? Because, like, I don't have access to water aerobics.
Yep. Yeah. And the constant insistence that, you know, you must have anxiety or other mental health issues is also a complicating variable when it comes to insurance. You know, because I have a variety of different medical issues and I am currently on disability, I have to make sure that my insurance company is going to still honor my actual disabilities and not focus on the mental health aspects and deny me everything, mm-hmm. you know, by claiming, oh, it's all due to anxiety. Because somehow, even though my doctors are treating me for what, like 6 out of the 8 major classifications of disabilities in the ICF, it doesn't matter. Because if I could potentially be depressed or anxious, which of course, you know, why would anyone with disabilities be depressed or anxious? Well, then that just explains it all. And therefore, we will deny you your insurance. And we then have a right to murder you, as Arena was saying earlier.
Yeah. And it becomes insurance murder. Yeah. You know, and at that point, I mean, it's worth bringing up, being female is a marginalization. Being a person of size is a marginalization. Being mentally ill is a marginalization. Let's talk about trans people for a moment. There's the thing that's referred to as trans broken arm syndrome, which is where a trans person who's on hormones will go to any doctor for anything. And the first thing that comes up is, well, could it be something that's happening as a result of the hormones you're taking?
Wow.
And that's why it's called trans broken arm syndrome, because if trans people will literally go to the emergency room and be like, I broke my arm. And they'll be like, well, what hormones are you on?
Yeah. And they'll be like, well, because your bone density is off because.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's obviously the hormones. Oh, yeah. The
hormones, including people who have been on the hormones for literally a matter of days. This happened to a former student of mine.
Great.
She'd been on her hormones for less than a week.
Well, and this, I was going to bring this up later, but it seems to fit right now. One of the things that I thought is obvious to me as a person who has two parents that are both physicians, but I don't ever hear anybody talk about, right, is that the leaders of the medical community, the people who are in charge of the AMA, the people who speak at FDA hearings, the people who are hospital, you know, chiefs of staff and stuff like that, were all going to medical school in the 70s. That's when my parents went to medical school. And so all these attitudes that you see in Crip Camp, in the documentary, about disabled people, about their medical care, those attitudes were very much in place when these people were trained. Mm. My father, to this day, believes that certain disabled people should be institutionalized. And because that's what he was taught in medical school. And nobody is doing anything that I can see in terms of continuing education to go back and pull some of these doctors that are not going through medical schools currently and go, okay, you were educated in this way about disabled people and it's not accurate and we know better now. And so we need to readdress some of this training. You know, both of my parents do continuing education credits to maintain their licenses, but none of the offerings ever seem to be about disability. And I don't know if that's because my parents are self-selecting, you know, topics of interest and that just isn't included, or if they're not even being offered, but I can tell you damn sure they're not being required.
Yeah, they're definitely not being required. Nicole has been doing work trying to get them more widely offered. I know that.
Can you explain what NICL is?
NICL is the National Council on Independent Living and is one of the major organizations trying to get, it's one of the big organizations trying to get disabled people more able to live in our homes with whatever assistance we need in the form of HCBS, which is home and community-based services, to live out of our homes with whatever services we might need to do that instead of living in an institution. The NICL is one group that's been working with that. ADAPT is another. ADAPT is the group that drafted the Disability Integration Act, is still going through the House and the Senate. And it's a relatively short piece of legislation. It's available online. It's a matter of public record that it's being sponsored by a number of politicians on both sides of the aisle. It's a piece of bipartisan civil rights legislation to essentially say that if it is not the medical recommendation, if it is not the medical requirement that somebody be institutionalized, that the funding must be directed to follow the person. It's what's called MFP, money follows the person, where instead of funding specific services in specific order, and then you say, okay, these are the services that are available, these are the people we'll fill people in order of the services. Instead,
the
we say, these, Instead, we say, these are the people, money follows the person, these are the people that we get funded, this is what the money will cover. What do they need?
Yeah. And that would have been so important for so many people I know.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's where you get the push to try and bring people out of these institutions, where the average life expectancy of someone who is institutionalized and doesn't medically need to be. So people who are institutionalized, not because they need to be in an institution, but because they can't do certain things for themselves and therefore need personal care, and there's no funding for personal care except in an institution, mm-hmm. you know, they'd be much better suited medically to simply have someone come in for, say, 10 hours a week.
Right.
But if the money's not there, the money's not there. And so instead of having somebody come to their house 10 hours a week, they're institutionalized. The average life expectancy of that person drops to a matter of months.
Yeah.
Looking at the section of the of Crip Camp talking about Willowbrook, what kept going through my head was a direct action that I participated in with ADAPT, where we were standing outside of Health and Human Services. I say standing, we're in wheelchairs. We had blockaded the doors to the HHS building. There's a group of probably around 80 people in wheelchairs, and beyond them was a set of police barricades. And then beyond that was the people who are like myself, who were running support and doing things like holding people's medications in case they got arrested, which they were almost certainly going to do. And this group of about 80 people started chanting in unison, "I'd rather go to jail than die in a nursing home." And watching, for example, a Black disabled man lock eyes with a DC police officer and chant, "I'd rather go to jail than die in a nursing home." And he started passing the microphone around and people started adding their own end to it. So it became, "I'd rather go to jail than die without my family. I'd rather go to jail than die missing my dog. I'd rather go to jail than die never seeing my children again. Within about 30 seconds, everyone was weeping as they were yelling these chants. And that was just what kept going through my head as I was watching the footage of Willowbrook.
I mean, it's a very real threat that is forever hanging over anyone with disabilities who, you know, really feels that there is no one who would step up to advocate for them or take care of them, which unfortunately, you know, even the people who do have people to advocate and take care of them, you know, when you have like husbands and siblings and children who are going to do their best for you and by you, may not even understand what exactly is at stake, even no matter how hard you try to tell them.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's been made all the more difficult by the fact that recent legislation has been passed that is protecting nursing homes from abuse lawsuits.
Right.
You know, and it's the kind of thing where you look at it and say, why are the nursing home lobbyists, which, I mean, that's a huge lobbyist group right there, which is kind of scary in and of itself. Why is the nursing home lobby fighting so hard to protect nursing homes from abuse lawsuits?
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, meanwhile, I can actually tell you that my mother was temporarily in a nursing home, and I found out later that friends of mine had actually had individual stays in that nursing home, and their roommates had died. 2 out of 6 people had a roommate who died while they were staying there, and no one came for the body or even noticed for quite a while. And that is appalling to me. That is absolutely appalling to me. That is something that still happens. Like, I think that we live in an area with good medical care. Like, I've always thought, okay, I'm smart. I've spent my life deliberately trying to make sure that I have the best medical care. I was born with disabilities. I've always been extremely proactive about everything. You know, I can protect my parents because I know more about this world than they do. I can do all the research. But I can't. None of us can. Because the system is deliberately set up to enable our death. And
well, and I will tell you, I have very mixed feelings on lawsuits in general, because I have seen what happens to patients in hospitals where the policies of the hospital are designed for risk mitigation and, you know, trying to protect themselves from malpractice lawsuits, as opposed to policies designed to benefit patients. You know, the mortality rate during labor and delivery in the United States is appalling compared mm-hmm. to other countries. Right. And a lot of those policies are because of trying to avoid lawsuits that lead to that, to those practices that are killing women. And so personally, I have a hard time with the idea of abuse lawsuits for nursing homes, because the nursing homes that most likely get sued are ones that are already underfunded. Mm-hmm. And when you take money out of the system, it's just making it worse for all of the people who are still stuck there. On the other hand, what I would really like to see is prosecution and incarceration of the people making those decisions and committing that abuse. And that is the piece that is missing. And it's the same thing with police brutality and all the rest of it. Like, you can't fix it with money.
Yeah.
You have to start putting some of these people in jail.
We've seen repeatedly that people who are at the corporate level with money can throw it wherever they want to. for whatever reason. And it really doesn't fundamentally matter because they can find some loophole somewhere where it doesn't hurt them anyway. And in this society, it's more about finding ways to achieve social justice and to redress the ills in our society that, you know, can actually do some good for the people still inside the system.
I agree. And I also think, particularly because of the way that insurance companies are run, you know, when you sue a hospital, when you sue a nursing home, you're not getting their money. You're getting money from their insurance company. Mm-hmm. And you may raise their premiums a little bit. You know, I don't think that that incentivizes people to make the right choices and make the right decisions. I think if anything, it incentivizes them to make sure that their victims cannot speak out.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and we don't have any way to combat that. If, you know, if a nursing home says that someone is not doing well, they're too sick for visitors, what are you supposed to say? Like, you can go to a judge and get a court order to compel them to give you access to your loved one and hope that you're not too late by the time it actually comes through, if it comes through.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't think that lawsuits are the answer. I think that we need a real accountability for the people who are committing these atrocities. And
one thing I think that is helping, actually, is the fact that in the age of COVID, we're finally getting a little bit of somewhere because of things like Zoom. Video conferencing is becoming a much bigger thing. And so virtual visitation has been a huge boon to people who are trapped in these institutions, simply because it's so much easier to get an impromptu look at what's going on in there in ways that it hasn't been possible to. You know, it was the kind of thing where, you know, say you have a loved one in one of these assisted living facilities and you have to give them 48 hours notice before you visit.
Right. Right.
You know, and you go there and, you know, they've had 48 hours to set everything up to their satisfaction. You know, and that's something that we know happens. But if it's a Zoom call, one of the things that's also being pushed right now is patient rights legislation to, for example, to say, you know, no, you can't take a patient's phone away. Mm-hmm. There's no medical reason to take their phone away. Therefore, you will not take their phone away. You know, to maintain rights like that, such that a patient who has a phone can get information out. Because that has been crucial for accountability in many of these institutions, ranging from places like nursing homes to places like the Judge Rotenberg Center in Massachusetts. It was cell phone footage that first exposed their use of punitive electric shock.
Mm-hmm. Most of the hospitals and nursing homes that I've been in, and some psychiatric wards when I was visiting as well, have these signs up that you can't use your cell phone because it interferes with their medical equipment. Yeah. And I have asked several nurses, tell me how it interferes. Show me the device that cannot function because of cell phone frequencies. And they have no idea. And I absolutely think that all of that is lawsuit mitigation. I don't think it has anything to do with science. But I'm also not an engineer, so I could be wrong.
Yep.
No, I can tell you, as someone who gets a lot of different medical procedures on the regular in areas that are marked with that sign, I have been told by the techs, you know, yeah, you just don't bring in your cell phone into this room, but, you know, because the metal in the room is an issue. Yeah, really? Then why are my glasses not an issue? Why are my hearing aids not an issue?
Yeah. Why does my phone not destroy my television or my microwave, but it apparently messes up your equipment? What's wrong with your equipment?
Yeah. See, there are very few things. For example, if you bring a cell phone too close to an MRI when it's turned on, cell phone will have a problem. But other than that.
But not the MRI machine.
Yeah,
right. The MRI machine is going to be fine. You know, it's the cell phone that's the problem.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so And it's the kind of thing, I've actually done this more than once, where I've gone in with a phone and they've said, oh, you need to turn your cell phone off. And they've pointed to the sign. And I've been like, oh, okay, sorry. Motion to turn my phone off, put my phone in my purse, leaving it on. They make motions to check everything. And they're like, okay, we're good now. Mm-hmm. I didn't turn my phone off. It's on in my purse. And they're acting like something changed because I turned my phone off.
Right, right.
Obvious crap.
Yeah.
What I was signing there was BS.
I know.
I love that sign.
It's useful. I could never use it in the classroom with my deaf students, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, it's also a very evocative one. You
know? It is. That's
an obvious one. I love it. But yeah, it's a complete lie. And I found that out by testing it. In among other things, the week after I had my hysterectomy, I was being moved all around the hospital in a whole bunch of different places, and I was like, "Huh, wonder." So mm-hmm. I used to make motions of turning off my cell phone and putting it away, and they'd be like, "Oh, okay, everything's good now. There's not any more interference."
Yeah,
I've heard them say, "Well, the radiation shielding interferes." But again, that's going to compromise the quality of your call. It's not damaging their radiation shielding.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I've also heard, you know, well, it interferes with people's pacemakers. And I'm like, really? Because everybody I know who has a pacemaker also carries a cell phone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
now what it does actually interfere with, interestingly enough, is the battery drives on the back of some wheelchairs.
Oh.
Somebody using a strong Bluetooth signal will cause my smart drive to stop.
Really?
Yep. I have to turn it off and on again.
Hmm. That's surprising.
Because it also operates on Bluetooth is the reason. And because it goes through my phone and then to a wristband, it's all controlled by the motions of my hand wearing this little watch. And that watch is then connected to both my phone and the drive itself by Bluetooth.
Okay.
And awesome. So because the device itself is Bluetooth.
That's incredible.
And so because that device itself is Bluetooth, it gets interfered with by other Bluetooth. I can't use my power drive inside cell phone storage. It just stops. Mm. It just doesn't work.
That sounds awesome. I have major wheelchair envy because I desperately want a wheelchair of my own that I don't have to rent. So that I can go out more and do more. And the biggest issue is I keep getting invited, not so much right now because everything is virtual, but before that I was invited to visit Congress and I was invited to speak at an FDA hearing, and I can't go because I cannot get from any point that Uber can drop you off to the buildings because of, you know, the security measures. You can't get right up to the door.
Yeah.
And I can't walk that far. It with any mobility device. But my insurance will not pay for a wheelchair because their metric of whether or not you need one is if you can get around your own home.
Yep. Yep.
And I'm just like, okay, but like, that's really unfair. Yeah. Because, you know, the fact that I can walk from my couch to my toilet, and that's as far as I can go unassisted, you know, does not mean that I can participate meaningfully in a full life outside of my freaking house.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
but they are not interested in any of us living full lives. They are exactly, interested in us subsisting.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, that's really what it comes down to. And I happen to be very lucky in that without assistance part is important because I actually cannot walk from my couch to my toilet without assistance, without falling down. Mm-hmm. And as it so happens, I have arranged my entire house that there's always something to catch. Mm. So what I do is I go from object to object to object to object if I don't want to use my wheelchair in the house. But I can't walk around my own home. And so I was able to qualify for it as a fall risk. Danielle, would a manual wheelchair be enough for you or no?
I can't operate a manual wheelchair because I have no wrist movement left.
Right. Okay.
So, and I could afford, if it was, if a manual would work, I'd just buy it myself and tell the insurance company to go fuck themselves. But unfortunately, I can't operate one. And if I have to have somebody there to push my chair, it completely defeats the purpose.
Yeah,
of,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's also a great website that both of you should look at. It's spinlife.com.
Mm-hmm.
They basically, they're a whole company. They're a distributor that has told insurance companies to go fuck themselves. And so they do direct pay.
Mm-hmm.
They don't take insurance at all. And so their prices are drastically lower.
Interesting. Hmm. Spin Life?
Yes, yeah, Spin Life.
I will have to look into that.
I am writing that down right now.
And so, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, yes, it's expensive still, but it's in the, like, the 1,000 instead of the 12,000 or the 15,000.
Right. That's what I've been seeing, is everything that I can physically operate myself is like $10,000 or more. And frankly, even if insurance would cover it, I can't afford 20% of that.
Yeah. The Spin Life has high quality collapsible power chairs for $2,000.
That's pretty great.
But yeah. To bring this sort of back to Crypt Camp, you know, one of the things that I think is so important about the way the whole film is structured is to give a sense of the history of the entire disability justice movement. And it kind of stops in the middle. I feel like it's a good part one of two of a film. I feel like there needs to be a sequel movie, because there's so much more history after the stuff that's covered, and there are some amazing people who are still working on incredible stuff in the movement. We've been getting more mainstream coverage this past few years, partly because of the protests around healthcare and things like that. Rachel Maddow did an incredible job of during the 2017 protests, she gave a sort of a background spiel on the history of the disability justice movement. It's up on YouTube. It's excellent. And covers some of the extra stuff that wasn't in Crypt Camp. So for anyone who saw Crypt Camp and is interested in what happened next, the Rachel Maddow history of the disability rights movement is a good place to go after that.
That's good to know. I thought, you know, when you just look at the doc for what it is and what it covers, I thought that it made perfect sense for them to talk about passage of the ADA as this huge milestone. You know, when previously you're talking about people who aren't even entitled to a public education, mm-hmm. you know, makes perfect sense. But when you kind of zoom out and look at where we are now, you know, the ADA is such a problematic piece of legislation, in my opinion. And there are, it just didn't have the impact that everybody wanted it to have, because there's no enforcement of it. You know, so it was difficult for me to kind of stick with them at the very end there. You know, I was loving it. I loved mm-hmm. all the vignettes. Mm-hmm. I loved the interviews, you know, with the activists and stuff like that. I found the description of the occupation of the HHS building very compelling. Mm-hmm. I especially appreciated when they were talking about cooperation with the Black Panthers. Mm-hmm. Although I wish they had had more footage of that.
Yeah, or even more discussion of it, if not right. more footage.
Right. You know, I thought that was all great. And then they talked about, oh, and then the ADA was passed. And I was like, yeah, but it's not doing. Like, all of these things that they wanted it to, you know, where they're talking about the motivations behind the ADA. And I, you know, I'm looking at it, you know,
25 years later.
I was trying to do the math. Yeah, 25 years later, going, okay, but it didn't do all of those things. You know, and I thought the one sort of nod to that a little bit was where
Judy.
Judy, thank you. I'm terrible with names. Where Judy, you know, they were asking her, are you excited? Are you proud? You know, what's your emotion about this? And she said something to the effect of, you know, I want to say I'm grateful, but on the other hand, I shouldn't have to be grateful just to be able to use a restroom.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
And, you know, I thought that was the first little glimpse into this idea that, yeah, it's a historic piece of legislation, but when you look at the fullness of what was needed and what they were actually able to get through Congress, it's so insufficient.
Yep,
it is.
Yep. And some of that is a matter of enforcement. One of the protests that happened that summer of 2017 was a gathering outside Jeff Sessions' apartment. And there was a gathering of protesters sort of in the courtyard. There's this like open courtyard that you can just access from the front. And about 200 of us gathered outside his building to protest the fact that he, as Attorney General, has chosen and has stated his intent, in fact, to not enforce the ADA and also to not enforce the IDEA and mm-hmm. also to not enforce mm-hmm. the Olmstead decision, which furthered the ADA and is the basis, among other things, for the Disability Integration Act. And so we were standing out there chanting, and, you know, we had a sort of printed list of demands asking, you know, for proper enforcement, et cetera. And we had a big poster-sized version of the sheet of paper that we were handing out that we taped to his front door, a la sort of Martin Luther. Two of his neighbors came out. One of them was a woman who came out and wanted to sort of give us water. She wanted to give us water and donuts and stuff because it was bright summer and very hot. And for various legal reasons, we couldn't accept any of that, but we were very appreciative of it. And she, you know, indicated her support and, in fact, joined ADAPT by the end of it. But the other one was another neighbor of his who came out and started yelling at us. And the response to him yelling was to hand him the microphone to, you know, hear what we had to say. And we actually, we debated with him because his first argument was, what are you doing here? This is unconscionable. Can't a man just have the right to live in his own home peacefully? And there was this pause. And then one of the sort of organizers of the protest just took the microphone back and said, yes, that's exactly why we're here. You know, that's all we want is the ability to live in our homes and our societies peacefully. That's exactly what we're asking for.
One question I sort of have is, what is one part of Crip Camp or one message that you saw in Crip Camp that you particularly want able-bodied folks who watch this movie to take away from it, if nothing else? Irina?
Disabled people are fucking badass.
All right.
I mean, it's shown in so many of those protests. I've watched an elderly woman with cerebral palsy hurl herself out of her power chair and crawl under a police barricade and between the legs of police officers to duct tape herself to the door of the Health and Human Services building in D.C. to get people out of institutions. And, you know, it's incredible watching these people. Anyone who watches the direct actions that people have been taking, that disabled people have been taking to further our own rights and our own autonomy, and then can think in any way that we're not capable, is not paying attention.
Mm-hmm. I thought, I think one of the most powerful parts of Crip Camp is actually the scene in the beginning at the camp where you see all these kids. I mean, they're teenagers, and even the counselors are in their early 20s. There's no, you know, senior members or anything. So all these kids are sitting around and all different forms of disabilities represented, and they're making leadership decisions about the camp. What's the menu going to be? Who's going to do the shopping? Who's going to do the cooking? You know, all this kind of thing. And then those same people you see later open that residential facility for disabled people that's run by disabled people. You know, and I thought that was so incredibly powerful as evidence of the whole theory of the social model of disability, that, you know, when you give people the support that they need and the access that they need, they can do anything, mm-hmm. you know, and just to, if anybody would watch this documentary and walk away with it, recognizing, you know, all these things I thought disabled people couldn't do is not because of their disability. It is because of the society that we live in. It's the society that I am complicit in. It is my responsibility to get these problems solved, not their responsibility to suddenly become more mobile.
That is an excellent, excellent point. And I think that's the point we're going to end this podcast on, because it's pretty brilliant. So I want to thank you both so much for coming on today. It's really, really wonderful to always be able to have a chat with the two of you, because I always know that you bring so much to the conversation that it's always incredible to me how much we learn from each other within the disability community. Mm-hmm. And how much we really rely on each other for so much. And I love the support we're able to give each other, even in conversations like this. So,
and especially in conversations like this, I want to thank you for providing a space where it's safe to talk about things like this. It's that's not something one can just find anywhere.
Yep, I agree.
So, thank you. Be safe.
Likewise.